One of the things that stuck with me was I had a meeting with former Premier Pat Binns, who I'd worked for, and someone who I looked up to and continue to look up to. And I said that I didn't think I was perfect for the job. And Pat said something that stuck with me that said, nobody's perfect for the job, but some people are perfect for the time. And perhaps that was some foreshadowing by Pat.
One year ago, Dennis King was elected to lead the first minority government in the history of Prince Edward Island. He came to the Premier's chair with a background in journalism, political backrooms, and a promise to do politics differently. No one could have imagined then the unprecedented crisis our province, country, and world community would experience at the hand of an unseen virus. Dennis King's good nature and openness to new ideas are at the center of Prince Edward Island's COVID response. And today he joins me to discuss this and more on the inaugural edition of Because Life is Local. Right off the top, let me give thanks to our show sponsor, Robin's Donuts, locally owned and operated by noted island businessman Kent Scales, with 13 outlets ready to serve you across PEI. Make sure you drop by Robin's Donuts today.
Because Life is Local is delighted to have our first ever guest, Prince Edward Island Premier Dennis King. Premier King, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad and honored to be the first one.
Listen, what's a normal day look like for you now?
Prior to the last couple of months, since COVID, it's hard to really remember what that is. But normally it would be me coming into the office sometime, around 8 o'clock in the morning. And there's usually a pile of papers on the desk. And you would go through them, some correspondence, and you look at the calendar and things you're going to do today. The little things that I have done from day one that I continue to do is, silly as it might sound, but I try to find 10 minutes to do the crossword puzzle and the jumble just to try to keep some kind of normalcy in my life and just to get away from everything and to think about something other than the pressures of the job.
And you were mentioning to me just before we started that you were handwriting a letter, and that's your practice now.
Yeah, I've done that really since day one as well. Two things. It does keep me normal. I've always viewed myself and still view myself as a writer. So to be able to have that outlet to write is important for me. And I just think one of the cool things would be if I wasn't in this job, if I were to get a handwritten letter from the Premier, that would be something that I would treasure and think it was really cool. So I try to write a letter quite often to people, a good accomplishment or from a sympathy perspective, or just as I wrote today to the Lieutenant Governor, reflecting on the past year and the great privilege it's been for me to get to know her. So,
interestingly, I haven't received one yet.
Well, stay tuned. Stay tuned.
It must be a post office thing, is it?
Well, most things I would say to you, I wouldn't want to put down on paper, probably.
Yeah, fair enough. You were elected a year ago, minority government. What were your expectations sort of the day after the election on what you could achieve in your first year, Dennis? I'm going to call you Dennis rather than Premier, even though I should call you Premier.
Well, I'll answer to either, but thank you. I think going into election night, we thought we could make a government. We didn't know what size it would be. Waking up the next day, realizing that we had, the opportunity to begin the process to form a government. It wasn't a foregone conclusion at that time, of course. But I think recognizing that people handed us a mandate, but not all of the power, that I really was hopeful that day, a year ago today, that the things that I had talked about in the leadership and in the election about how we need to work together and put party politics aside, I thought the verdict and the mandate from the people allowed me to actually do that. So I was excited to put that into practice. And a year later, I think one of the things that I'm most proud of is that we've actually put the action behind the words.
What scared you the day after you were elected?
Oh, the fact that I might be premier was absolutely you know, both really cool and really terrifying, to be honest. I mean,
when you decided to run for leadership, did you think you would be premier? Like, what was the thought process in terms of deciding?
I obviously, you get into this, what that would be the end goal. I really, really, and I joke about this, but it's only half jokingly. I really, really thought that if I could run in the leadership and get 49% and be so close to win, that people for the next 50 years would say, God, he was almost there. You know, that would have been a pretty cool verdict, I would have thought. But, you know, as we get into it, I got a little bit more comfortable with the fact that somebody like me could sit in this chair. I think that was a big, and I talked to you about this before many times, a big hang up for me running for this job was the people who've always sat in this chair really weren't, you know, the guys who grew up like me, a small town in Georgetown royalty who, you know, who didn't, you know, wasn't a lawyer or anything like that. So the job never seemed that it was there for me. And then, but as the election rolled on and the leadership, I got a little bit more comfortable and it became more of a reality. And it was, but it's still terrifying every day, to be honest. It really is.
I think we should go back to some of the conversations and have full disclosure. And there was two people on the conversations and one of the two people told the other that they weren't qualified to be premier. And I'll let the listeners decide who told whom what. But that was, that speaks to sort of my sort of preconceived notions on what skills a premier needed. But what was it about you internally, Dan, that said, you know, I know what some people think and I know what I think I can offer, so I'm going to go anyway.
Yeah, like I think everybody has within them the belief in themselves to do certain things. I knew I could come to the job and do the things that I talked about because I had been around it enough to know, you know, what the job entailed and how my unique abilities could help with that. I've always felt that I was good with people and then that people have a comfort level in speaking to me and talking with me. And a big part of politics is being able to communicate with people. So my fear in the job and some of the things that people like you pointed out was, you know, I'm by no means a policy wonk. You know, I don't, ever prescribe to be that or try to be that. But I thought I had a unique skill set that would be useful for the time. And one of the things that stuck with me was I had a meeting with former Premier Pat Binns, who I'd worked for, and someone who I looked up to and continue to look up to. And you know, I said that I didn't think I was perfect for the job. And Pat said something that stuck with me that said, nobody's perfect for the job, but some people are perfect for the time. And perhaps that was some foreshadowing by Pat, but maybe that was the case.
I would definitely say there's truth in that. Leaders step up. And you assume some people are going to be leaders and sometimes they're not. And sometimes people who you don't think will be leaders turn out to be great leaders. But let's talk about how you evolved. Dorian was but important.
But before we get there, can I just say that, and I gave you a hard time and many people did, but I mean, let's be brutally honest. I kind of came to the job as a comedic storyteller, a writer, you know. I wasn't someone known to take himself overly seriously. And one of the challenges that I had and probably still have is for people to take me seriously. So, I mean, a lot of the, you know, suspicions or thoughts or lack thereof that people had, I think were very well earned and well deserved.
It was interesting. I remember a conversation we had at Timothy's. It was a good animated conversation. And I was telling you why you weren't qualified to become leader of the opposition and then premier ultimately. And you said you're too close. That's the exact phrase you use. You're too close to it. And it's absolutely right because you can't, when you've known someone and we've known each other basically our whole lives. And we've worked together before. It was 3 years ago, you won Outstanding Feature Award for the Eastern Graphic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
A tragedy. But I think perhaps the lesson for both of us is that if you assume, there's a good chance you're wrong.
Well, I think so. But I mean, I think I put that also on myself to because I didn't need to just show Islanders that. I mean, quite honestly and brutally honestly, I had to show myself that. You know, I mean, if you look at the person who sat in this chair before me, I mean, he is, you know, an exceptional Islander in every way. He's brilliant. He's thoughtful. He thinks policy. And for somebody like me to come in after him, I think maybe my communication, et cetera, is a breath of fresh air. But there's also the responsibility that is so serious in the job and that he brought to this job every day that I had to challenge myself. And I still challenge myself every day to try to rise above what people thought I could do and maybe even, quite honestly, what I thought I could do.
There was a certain awe, I think, to winning the first the leadership and then the election and then becoming premier. And all of sort of the downstream stuff that flow from that. You get to talk to the prime minister, you get to talk to provincial premiers, you get to have Bob Rae phone you up and talk about minority governments. Can you speak to sort of that?
Well, I mean, you talked about you and I knowing each other for so long. I mean, I'm at root a sports junkie and a political junkie. I mean, I love this stuff more than anybody. So talking to the prime minister or talking to Bob Rae is like talking to Wayne Gretzky for me. This is like you pinch yourself. So just the ability to be able to do that, to look at my phone and go through the index of to have every premier's number. I can just pick a number and they will mostly answer on the first ring. The prime minister is so foreign to me, but so cool at the same time that it's just an amazing thing that someone who's covered politics like I have and that you have, for that to be so real for me is really something I still adjust to and try to adjust to.
Have you found as you've navigated sort of the necessity to put PEI first or as high on top of the pecking order as you can in Ottawa or wherever, that everything, be it talking to a major business owner or a federal cabinet minister or the prime minister or an ambassador, everything is a personal relationship in life?
Well, I mean, it certainly helps. And I think everything that we do, you know, conducting business, just conversation, all needs to start from somewhere. And to have that, you know, I really do think most people would say about me that he's very easy to talk to. He's enjoyable to talk to. He seems caring, and seems quite, you know, just on a personal level, very genuine. So that's when I met the prime minister for the first time, that's the conversation. I felt the very same about him that I think he felt about me. It was a very easy conversation. He didn't seem like the prime minister to me. He seemed like just a guy that you could go and have a beer with and have a chat with. And I think he felt the same about me. And look, I probably brought to that whole conversation, you know, I was the only progressive conservative that wasn't trying to tear the hide off him every time he turned around. So maybe that was allowed us to have a little bit of a friendship or a relationship. But it's the same thing when you talk to anybody. When I went to Toronto and sat around a boardroom table, a law office, and had all of these lawyers and business people in Toronto, and here I was talking about how we do politics different in Prince Edward Island, and you know, people were leaving saying, God, that was a great, inspiring speech. And the whole time I was saying, what the heck am I doing here with all these highfalutin guys? But, you know, those moments to me tell me that really, like my dad and like your dad used to say, that they may hold a different position. They might come from a different place, but they're really just the same. They put their pants on one leg at a time like we do. And what I have found, and I say this not to boast or anything, but none of them are any smarter than you and me, and most of them don't have as much common sense as you and me.
So who surprised you among the premiers or cabinet ministers? Like,
well, can we do both? I mean, so right away, I took up really quickly a very, very close relationship and a good friendship with Dwight Ball. I think PEI and Newfoundland have so much in common, but he's just a personality like me. He loves the Montreal Canadiens. He's funny. You know,
don't hold that against him.
And we just picked up really quickly. But, you know, Doug Ford, I text Doug Ford as much as I text anybody. And you know, look, the Doug Ford you see on TV is one thing, but Every meeting I've been in with Doug Ford, be it in person or on the phone, he is the most caring person. He's always trying to look out for somebody else, sending people PPE, doing these things. And what I find funny about all this is I told a person at an event at the Confederation Center, there was an art opening, and I met this lady, a very, you know, established lady, who had an opinion of Doug Ford, and it wasn't a good one. And I told her that just what I told you about how genuine he is, and her quick reaction was, but he's just a pig of a man, isn't he? Like, you know, so people want to believe something, or they have been, they have taken this belief from this person they have seen on TV, and they don't want to be open to that. But he is one of the nicest guys I have ever met.
Wow. Wow. But let's jump to Dorian. Cause I personally think that that may have been a turning point in terms of your leadership. Up until that point, it may have been part of getting your team in place and doing the things that you wanted them to do throughout government. But certainly during Dorian, you were criticized for sort of fawning to or taking the word of the advice without question. That was the appearance. And you were criticized for it as a government. Is there truth to that?
Oh, I think I was criticized for it. Yeah, I mean, but like, look, what I've done in this job right off the bat was, and I joke off the time, there's 158,000 advisors. Some of them are more vocal than others. There's lots of people like you and others who are paid to give their opinion. And you have to be aware of that. You have to respect that. But you need to be guided by something more so than that. So we were perhaps criticized. I don't think it was a fair criticism. I had a hurricane in place. We have officials with the emergency measures organizations who are employed to lead during that time. So I worked closely with them. I gave them all the resources that they needed to do. And I watched along quite closely with them. And I met with them every day, asked them the same questions I asked Dr. Morrison every day. What more resources do you need? What more can I do to help you do your job? So I don't think Dorian was a turning point for me personally.
What did you learn about your leadership skill during Dorian?
Well, I think it validated what I tried to bring to the job, and that was that you have to be a good listener. I'm not an expert in anything, and I don't ever try to be an expert in anything. I try to learn, I try to listen, I try to work with those who are around the room. I don't try to enforce my views and push it down their throats, but I make my, my views known. But I'm open to good ideas, and I'm open to good people who care. And so EMO in that regard was great. And so when you fast forward to COVID, we're in a public health emergency. Who better to lead a public health emergency than the person we pay to do this every day in Dr. Morrison?
I don't disagree. I guess my question then would be, how does listening translate into action when you're going back to on an ordinary day for you? And is it difficult to remain a listener as you become more secure being premier?
No, it hasn't for me yet, but I mean, I am just a year in, obviously, so I still try to learn. I think it's always been my style to be a good listener, but I do realize the responsibility in the job, and the decisions need to come from me. I disagree often with people who provide advice. I mean, I don't listen to it and take it, 100% all the time. I have a good instinct for some of these things, so I know what we need to be doing, but I try to follow advice and make decisions for the right reasons. That is part of the reason I don't listen to the political panel or read the columns, no offense, but I can't allow that to infiltrate my thinking to change the way I address issues. Yeah. And someone called me the other day and said, Paul McNeil wrote a good article about you, you should read it. And I said, well, I can't read the good if I'm not going to read the bad. So I just, I hope you said some nice things about me, and I'm grateful.
The bad in quotation marks is merely suggestions for how to provide better governance.
Absolutely. And we need that. And I'm not afraid of that one bit, but I don't need to read it from you to know what, to what Islanders are thinking or suggesting.
Listen, for a good listener, What was it that made you, because you started raising this on the political panel when we were both on CBC, was that islanders were ready for a new style of government, sort of where cooperation was put before politics. I mean, how did that percolate in your mind and actually become what became known as your brand?
And let's be honest, you didn't believe it for a second, did you?
I didn't. I didn't.
Okay. The one thing I learned from your late father was when I worked for him and when I started my career is to try to talk to 50 people every day. And I've done that my whole life. I like to talk to people and I listen. I'm a good listener and I'm able to retain. I thought for the last couple of years, I was picking up a vibe where people were really growing tired of politics. I think you look at the Trump factor, and even going back beyond that, the Obama factor. As much as people on the left loved Obama, the people on the right hated him. Same, it's equal, only it's reversed now when it comes to Trump. And I thought people in Canada, people in Prince Edward Island were getting really, really sick of that whole, the partisan nature. And somewhere in that, that people were lost and people cared more about what you would do for the PC party as opposed to what you would do for John and Peter's Road, for example. And I thought people had grown tired of that. And I think quite honestly, to give them credit, I think Peter Bevan Baker was early picking up on that as well. And look, so but I think it comes from places like Rotary and Lions Club. You get all of these people from different points of view, different standings in life, different religions, different political views, and they put all of that aside to sit at a table and do the right things for islanders or for the groups they serve. So why would it be any different in politics? And I really believed it. And the joy of this journey for me to date was seeing people come up to me now and saying, I didn't think you could do it. I didn't think it was possible, but man, I think you might have changed politics.
Well, let's talk about COVID and how it has changed perhaps the perception of a great number of islanders about your capacity to lead. Let's go back 2.5 months. There were 3 months roadblocks. Was that January?
Yeah, so it was early in the year. So I tell you where I first started to really pick up on COVID is we had put together a situation table dealing with the rail blockades. We were having some real serious challenges with the supply chain coming to PEI with the disruptions and all of these things. And as those meetings were taking place, we would get reports from the emergency measures organization people, and they would say, we're having trouble getting this through the rail blockades, but an issue also is some of our building supplies that are coming out of China because of this coronavirus. So from that point on, we've started to pay attention, obviously, to what was going on. Now you fast forward until now, I mean, everybody in the world knows what COVID-19 and coronavirus is, but those first few days and few meetings, I don't think anybody really thought we would get to where we're at right now.
So was that when you first really met Dr. Morrison, Dr. Heather Morrison?
Well, I mean, I've known Dr. Morrison over the course from one of her two of her daughters used to, and maybe one of them still take riding lessons from my wife, Jana. So I might have seen her around enough to wave to her and say hi. And then just when I might have seen her in the basement of the Shaw building when I come to work. But I never really had a conversation with her beyond hi until probably the, you know, early in March of this year.
So how did that relationship evolve? I mean, it's seen as a competent working relationship of a government relying on the public health officer to provide prudent advice for public safety, but also the government, when necessary, sort of looking for a common sense way around some ticklish issues, and also delivering programs that are necessary to individual islanders and interest groups across the province.
Well, I think it began. I think we respect each other. Like I have a tremendous respect for her capacity to do what she does. You know, for those who don't know, I mean, she's a Rhodes Scholar. I mean, she has a capacity to comprehend things that people like you and I could never even begin to think about. So it comes from a place of respect. And I think over, at least I hope over the course of the last couple of months, we've gotten to know each other. I think she respects me, the ability to communicate, to help her communicate. I think maybe with her expert skill and my sort of a more down to earth street component, I think it's a really good mix. I think that I know she will say to me whenever we go on to do the briefing, she will say to me after, wow, I wish I could, you know, communicate and simplify a message like you do. And I'll say to her, you know, I wish I didn't have to do that. But that's as much for me as it is for everybody else. So I think we like each other personally. I think she respects what I bring to the table as much as I respect what she brings to the table. But I think we're just united in trying to do the best we can to get people through this.
Did your time in self-isolation, was it actually beneficial for you in terms of getting your own footing on how to manage this thing so you're not in the buzz of the office? Tell me about that those 2 weeks.
You know, I think quite honestly, I would say that the advantage in that for me was, I think it allowed me to be singularly focused on the issues and the operation of the office. Because I wasn't here, if you're in this office every day, people come and go, they're you know, people are busy, they're going hell west and crooked. And you don't always get a chance to say, the chief of staff should be in this lane, the principal secretary should be in this lane. And I think my time in self-isolation allowed me to get singularly focused on how the office worked, how I interacted with them a little bit differently and a little bit more effectively. So I think that was a great opportunity for me. But I also learned a lot about, you know, the need to focus. I mean, you and I joke about this all the time. There's lots of things you could call me, but being focused and organized wouldn't be the two first words that would jump to your mind. But during those 2 weeks,
that's true.
I had the ability to and the necessity to really get dialed in and focused. And
well, how did you decide priorities during that period? You know, because there were so many moving balls, Premier, you know, from the $25 million fund for business to, you know, the isolation, you know. There were so many moving balls. So how did you pick the priorities?
Well, look, we do have a good team. So it was determined right off the bat that this being a public health situation, that from a public health perspective, we would let Dr. Morrison and her office tell us what we need to be doing and how we need to be acting from a health perspective. And that was the cabinet and everybody around the situation tables have bought into that from day one. And then you start to look at, you peel back the layers of this and you realize people are going to be impacted. When you're not letting people go to work, when business has stopped, you need to be able to find a way. So, I mean, we just, we work with industry. We work through Matt McKay and his office and all those people. And you really, the ability you have in PEI is to be able to bore down really quickly on the areas that need it. And I think we did that. We had one overarching goal, and that was get money into the hands of people who need it as fast as we can. And we did that, and I'm proud of how we reacted to that, and I think in that regard, we probably have led the country.
Let me say a word of thanks to our sponsor today, Robin's Donuts. There are 13 Robin's Donuts across PEI, serving up the tastiest coffee and baked goods, made fresh daily. Even the eggs on Robin's breakfast sandwiches are fresh cracked, never frozen. In these difficult times, it's important to support those who support you. And owner Kent Scales and his team are second to none in supporting island communities. So make sure you stop by Robin's Donuts today.
Is it fair to say that your upbringing in Georgetown royalty may have played a role in terms of how you viewed government's response to this crisis?
Well, I think so, yes. But I think it also helps me in my day-to-day operations with the bureaucracy and as we develop policy all along. Because I will often ask the question when people come in and they present policy and this is going to do this and that, and our GDP will go up by this and that, and all of these factors that are important. And I will always say, well, what will it do for the guy in Peters Road? And people, the first when I start asking that, people would say, where's Peters Road? And I'd say, exactly. And that's what I think I've been able to bring to all of the policy and the issues and the approach around this is to live up to what I've been talking about, is that people are at the end of all this. So it's great that we say there's a student fund for this person or that person, but in PEI and where we come from, I know the faces who are at the end of this. I know how much they need this. I know how quickly they need it.
You must have had a moment or two or three of just absolute gut check when businesses were closing, industries were closing. What jumps to mind when that type of visceral reaction is raised with you?
Well, it kind of all came home for me. So here we had gone to Ottawa for First Ministers, which was canceled on our approach. So we're sitting at the hotel, I think we're at the Laurier, waiting to go to a cab to catch our flight. And we look out in Ottawa, and there's not a car moving in Ottawa. And so that's when I looked at Paul Ledwell and said, this is really, really serious. And then you get the call from Dr. Morrison, who says, Premier, when you come home, you're going to have to self-isolate because we're putting these things in place. And then, so I'm coming home and I'm sitting down and I'm home and I'm like, I'm home here for 14 days. I can't move out. I look out. I live on Route 2. The cars zip by there. There's no cars driving by. And you're like, oh my God, like, is this Armageddon? Like, what are we at? And then you start to get the calls from the Kevin Murphys of the world that's saying, I'm laying off 400 people. And you get the call from, the Public Service Commission say, everybody has to work from home. I don't know what we're going to do. And so there's a million of these, oh my God, moments. How are we going to get through this? But they're also followed up every day, Paul, with, us doing something that we never thought we could do or never thought we would need to do. So it's kind of there's two ends of it. But,
it's interesting. You and I have spent pretty close to an equal amount of time analyzing government over the years. And one of the things that I think we can say about every government, regardless of political party, is the inertia that can take place. Great ideas have often died in the bureaucracy. But in a crisis like this, the fear of being wrong has been set aside to just get it done. How do you maintain that? Because I think a lot of people would look at this situation and say, the easy part may be what we're dealing with right now. The hard part will be rebuilding the economy, government.
Listen, I think this is hard. Don't get me wrong. And I think there's a lot of hard work ahead too. And part of the fear and challenge is the unknown, is we don't know how hard it will be. We can only anticipate. I live every day knowing that I can't open this up for some fast enough. I can't close it down, slow enough for some. But I try to live by really trying that the real reality is that if I get it wrong, it can't be wrong to where there's illness, sickness, and death. And that's really what we balance here every day. Like, if we get some of these things wrong, people could die. So can you imagine the pressure and responsibility in this? So why are we going cautiously? Why are we taking our time? Why are we easing our way into this? Because we can't afford to get it wrong if the result is death. So if people have to get upset or mad with me because we're not opening quick enough, we can't get a business open on the 1st instead of the 15th, I can live with that. But God, it's going to be really hard to live if we get it wrong the other way.
Agreed. And the flip side too is then when there was criticism of the decision to close liquor stores, to my mind, that was reflective of a government just trying to do what's right and figuring it out basically on the fly, which is not a criticism. It's reality.
It's the reality. Yeah.
I think Stephen Myers told me he had a half hour notice that they were shutting the liquor stores down.
we were trying to mobilize quickly. I mean, the directive was we can't have these things open. We got to get them closed. But I hope we've also demonstrated that we know we haven't been perfect. We haven't been afraid to come back and say we got this one wrong and we changed this. So, I mean, I think I really do at their heart. Islanders appreciate the fact that me and the style of government that we have here is that we're really not trying to be perfect and walk around and tell everyone that everything we're doing is right. I mean, I think people can relate to that. I think that's the way we live our lives mostly. So we've got a lot right, and the job here is to get more right than you get wrong. And I think if you do that, people will at least at the end of the day say, you know, he tried his best. But
how do you transition though, Dennis? I think it's probably a fair guess that our provincial deficit is going to approach $100 million or more. We've had that type of deficit before, but yeah. Part of the issue on a go forward basis is the impact that COVID will have on our tax base. And the federal government's tax base, because they provide 43% or so of our provincial funding. So how do we begin to roll out the carpet again? And have you even transitioned or begun the discussions of what that could look like, what the obstacles, the hindrances could be? And what do you take? The education system has rolled out education at home, you know, to varying success, but they did it quickly. So how do you decide what was a good effort to fight COVID that we might be able to transition into long-term government policy?
Yeah, like I think that there's a couple of questions wrapped up in there. Like I think we will need a multi-year approach to deal with this, because it's going to take that long for us to get back. And the economy is going to be slow to pick up, the really big void that has been left here. So I don't think it's fair to say that, you know, we're going to spend $50 million now to assist people and then expect to get it back through increased taxes or something in year one. So we need to have a long-term plan, and that's what we're looking at. But from a perspective of, it's about 60% when you take in all of our federal transfers, what we get from the federal government. So that will be consistent for this year and then next. There's a fear, though, about the equalization and the transfer formula beyond that because of the Canadian economy. So that's a worry we have on the horizon for sure. But there's also the spin-off economy that's not going right now. You talk about it, that business has stopped. And so business is going to pick up again, but it's going to take a long time for that to get back to the pace, if we ever could, where we were. Bioscience has still been strong. It's probably stronger now.
What's it going to look like this winter, though? I mean, that's one of the things, the reality.
That's a good question. That's a good question.
Fish and vermin.
Yeah. I think there will be a need for federal and provincial economic rollout to continue long past the COVID, virus itself. So I think that we will both need to come to the table to make sure that Islanders, are looked after, or at least in some capacity, able to have some money coming in. I think our economy will rebound faster than most because we have the ability to do so. But I worry about tourism. I mean, tourism's, you know, our third biggest industry here in PEI. And, I think we talk honestly, if we could get 10% of our tourist industry this year, it would be nearly a miracle. So that's a lot to pick up. That's a lot of miss. That's a lot of loss. And my fear looking to the winter, Paul, is that with all of the federal programs as they're rolling out, there's a lot of people who aren't going to be EI insurable come the fall, which is difficult in PEI at the best of times. But when you throw in the economic situation we're at, that's going to be an even bigger problem. So I've been pounding away at the federal government that we have to find a way to make sure that we have EI insurable earnings for Islanders and Canadians heading into the late fall and the winter.
Have you surprised yourself at any time? You know, has something happened where you've thought, immediately or right or after at some point, Jesus, I can't believe Dennis King just did that?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to say, because I really haven't spent much or any time thinking about that. I think there are times, like a couple of weeks ago, I brought up an issue about the fishery, and I was, you know, I was pretty firm and out of character firm for me with the Prime Minister. And to get a call back from his office to say the Prime Minister recognize the sense of frustration in your voice, and to get action on that. I thought that was a pretty nice moment for me personally, and will help people going forward.
But that was also probably an example of picking your battles, because basically, and you had said it publicly, Premier, was the federal government, the Department of Fisheries and Ocean, was basically trying to have their cake and eat it too, by asking for input, and they may or may not take it. And they've deflected everything back to the people who are harvesting the resource or processing the resource.
Yeah, I thought that that fishers in this province were being treated differently than anybody else was. And that's what I was talking about, is that if no one here is going to stand up and say, we don't want you to go fishing, but if you don't go fishing, here's a package that we could look at. If what they were doing to the fishers of PEI was saying, essentially, you can go fishing if you want, and there's a lot of uncertainty in that, but if you don't go fishing, you can't make any money. And we weren't doing that as a country to any other sector other than the fishery. So that's what frustrated me and still frustrates me, quite honestly. But, but at the same time, I'm not always on that call beating the crap out of the prime minister. I'm the first one to step up when something is good for PEI and to give him the credit for that. So I think because we have that kind of relationship and because it's such an important relationship for us as a province, I think in the early going, at least, that's been an advantage for me and for PEI. I think he very much feels like he has an ally in me, and maybe it's an ally that he didn't think he could possibly have. But I think it's important that you give people the credit for the things they do, along with being critical of the things they're not doing well.
Where do we go from here? We're sort of in a period where it's looking like we've got this thing under control, although rebounds are very possible. Community transmission, if we open it up too early, is very possible. How do you strike a bet? What does success look to you in September or October?
Well, I think if I could, and I said this to some staff here, that success for me would be we start to roll back on May 1st. We continue to keep the virus at bay. We work into the middle of late June, where we can open up the bridge to at least some kind of traffic, and I don't know how that looks now. But success for me to show that we're on the right track would be somehow, in some way, shape, or form, we're able to have an Old Home Week or a Gold Cup and Saucer race, something. I know it will look differently than it has in the past, but if we could have that, and people that we haven't, seen the community spread, we haven't seen the case level to the extent other provinces have, that would tell me that we're on the road here to getting through this. And at the same time, we got to put the work boots on and our hard hat on and roll up our sleeves and get to work to try to rebuild the economy.
This also creates significant opportunity, I'm guessing, in terms of the economy and reimagining it and new opportunities.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things from day one that I've asked every minister to look at is to find the efficiencies and the differences in things we're doing now, because we have to, and what can be applied going forward. I mean, last December, I was talking to Public Service Commission as a carbon reduction opportunity to have people work from home a day a week or so, and was told at that time that it was basically impossible, that it would never happen. And now 90% of the workforce for the public service is working from home. So there's an opportunity.
If you're looking at rural community revitalization, that could be a part of it.
Absolutely. And look at healthcare. I mean, virtual care now is something that it is people are gravitating toward it. And if you talk about rural revitalization, people probably want to live now more in a place where we're not all so closely and densely populated. So there's an opportunity here for rural PEI to grow with the change in how we look at the services we need to offer. We need to offer core services, but we can do it maybe more uniquely than we've had before. And I think that's there's innovation and ingenuity that's wrapped up in the challenge here. And we're finding it, I hope, and I want to continue to explore.
I'll finish it up with this, Dan. On election day last year, Gary Evans, your good friend who was driving you around, took a very dramatic photo that you didn't know was being taken of you visiting your father's grave, Lionel King. how would he react? Because he was a humble guy from Boughton Island to, A, you becoming premier, but I think more interested in the leader that you've evolved into for the times that it that we needed one.
Well, I always hope he's proud. I look up at that photo. I'm looking at it now, and it's that's an emotional time for me. That photo and Gary giving it to me, it meant so much to me. What a gesture it was from him. But I think that he would be one of the people, and I've had many in my life who probably believed I was capable of something like this. I worked hard, damn it, to show them that I didn't, or I didn't want it. But there's a lot of people who believed I had, an ability to be more than what I was and to grow into the job. So, I think that he was such a political junkie, he would be so proud. I hope he would be proud of how we've conducted business in here on a regular basis. And I really hope that he would appreciate, like many Islanders do, that, there's a lot of Islanders who grew up like you and I did, who maybe feel more a part of this than they've had in a long time. So.
Do you think that he would be able to get over the fact that you're a Tory and not a Liberal?
I think it would be tough. I still think if he was living, if we could get him to spoil his ballot, it might be a small victory. Although he was a very loyal Liberal, no, there's no question. Dad was always one of the people too who was never afraid to bob when the rest of them were weaving. So I think I got a little bit of that from him. When we turn politics on its ear a little bit, I think he would take some pleasure and satisfaction in that too.
Premier Dennis King, let's leave it at that. We very much appreciate you joining us for the first ever Because Life is Local podcast. Last one, who knows? But this is a good conversation.
This is a good one. I I've been after you for a long time to get this going. So it was great. I kid you all the time. I always talk about how irrelevant your political views are, but there are many, many Islanders who listen and read you religiously, and you've developed a great following, and you piss me off, but I'm proud of you too.
Keep on not reading. Thank you, Premier. Okay, all the best.
Well, that's a wrap for Edition 1. Thanks to Premier Dennis King for taking the time. And thanks to our sponsor, Robin's Donuts. Make sure you drop by any one of the 13 locations across PEI. It's never been more important to support businesses that support our island communities. Thanks for listening. I'm Paul McNeil. We'll see you again soon, because life is local.